This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
Around the world, over 100 million people are living with hepatitis C, and without treatment, they're in danger of severe liver disease. The big problem, millions of those people have no idea they have the virus.
So it's actually a rather new disease, and most people don't have symptoms. It's a silent virus, so they don't go to their doctor, and the physician's usually not looking for it.
On today's Health Show, we'll get the facts about hepatitis C.
Then we'll find out about a much less common problem, Sjogren's syndrome, and why it's leaving many people dry. And Sandy D returns, looking for love. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. Sometimes it seems like the baby boomers had all the fun. Right now, however, they're in the center of a large rise in hepatitis C cases. There are 5 million Americans living with the virus, and a large number of them have no idea they have it. It's become the 10th leading cause of death in the U.S., and doctors are not even close to developing a vaccine. Here to talk about hepatitis C is Dr. Tuesday Stainbrook, an infectious disease physician in central Pennsylvania. Dr. Stainbrook has a large hepatitis C treatment population where she practices and is considered to be one of the largest hepatitis C providers in Pennsylvania. She's written a book about the disease called Hepatitis C, What You Need to Know. We spoke recently, and I asked her to give us the basics of hepatitis C.
All right. Hepatitis C is a viral hepatitis. It's actually blood-borne hepatitis, so you have to get it usually blood-to-blood. There are several risk factors for hepatitis C. What we see now is that 80 to 90% of new cases are from intravenous drug use. But that doesn't mean everyone got it from intravenous drug use. There's other ways to getting it, such as transfusion with blood or blood products before 1992. Or if you had clotting factors before 1987, if there's a needle stick injury from healthcare records from those who were infected with hepatitis C, children can get it if their mother would have hepatitis C. And then there's also untraditional risk factors people don't realize, such as tattoos and with unsterilized needles, pedicures, manicures. If they had an endoscopy, like a scope down their stomach, or a colonoscopy, and those were not sterilized correctly, they could also be at risk for hepatitis C.
There seems to be some controversy as to whether it can be sexually transmitted.
Well, it can be sexually transmitted. The risk is low. I tell people it's a 10% lifetime risk. If you're in a monogamous relationship, meaning that you're only having sex with one person and you know that person, then the CDC does not even recommend condoms. But if you do not know your sexual partner and how many other people they've had sexual intercourse with, then you should use condoms. There's several things that would increase that risk sexually. If someone have other sexually transmitted diseases, that definitely increases the risk of transmission of hepatitis C.
Well, now, there are two types of hepatitis C, the acute and the chronic. And from what I've seen, it looks like some people might get acute hepatitis C and never even know it.
Yeah, I always like to tell people that if we had 100 people in a room and they all got infected with hepatitis C, most of the people would go on to have chronic hepatitis C. That means 85 of those people in that room would go on to have chronic hepatitis C. 15 of them would actually not really get any symptoms. A few will get some symptoms, which would be acute hepatitis C. When the body has symptoms, that means the body sees a virus and fights it. So those people tend to be the young females that tend to have acute hepatitis C and do not go progress on to have chronic hepatitis C. But most people who are exposed to hepatitis C will develop chronic hepatitis C, meaning that they'll always have virus in their blood and in their liver, causing liver damage.
And that can only be treated and controlled. That can't be cured.
That is the biggest misconception out there. It can be cured. It cannot be cured in everybody. But with the new medications that were recently released from the FDA in May of last year, 2011, up to 80% of people can be cured now. Not everybody, but a lot of people I want to get that message out there that there are now good medication that can be used to treat hepatitis C. And people don't realize that hepatitis C not only affects your liver, but it can also affect other parts of your body. It can give you vasculitis, which are sores on your arms or legs. It can be a precursor for depression and diabetes. It can even affect your kidneys.
Is there any possible, if you get acute hepatitis C and it just works its way through your body and goes away, are there any like future complications of that, or are you just done with that?
No, you don't have any complications if you clear the virus. Now, you'll always have an antibody, and that's the screening test that currently the Red Cross uses to screen blood. An antibody is just a memory cell, and that's the screening test that most people do. That doesn't mean someone has chronic hepatitis. It just means they were exposed to hepatitis C. You have to actually go and do that PCR or viral load to see if there's virus in their blood. So with that screening test, you can't tell if someone has acute hepatitis C, chronic hepatitis C, if they've cleared the virus, or if they still have virus in their blood.
If it's left untreated or uncontrolled, what happens in the long run for someone with hepatitis C?
Well, it takes a long time to do a lot of liver damage in most people, but everyone progresses at a different rate. If you drink alcohol, you'll progress faster and you could develop end-stage liver disease. You could develop liver cirrhosis. It's also a risk factor for liver cancer. So alcohol, if you're co-infected with any other hepatitis virus, such as hepatitis B, then you could progress faster. You could progress faster if you have an HIV infection. Like I said, it usually takes 20 or 30 years for end-stage liver disease or liver cirrhosis, but everyone's different. I've had a 26-year-old walk in with liver cirrhosis. So the best time to be treated is now, because when you're young, chances of treatment success are even higher. Now with the new medication, I don't believe anyone's waiting. The medication do have a lot of side effects, and they also have a lot of drug interactions. So it is still a difficult treatment, but I think that it's better than waiting for the new stuff, which is probably going to be another 3 to 4 years before anything new comes out.
If somebody has been living with this for a long time, can they still be helped by these new medications?
They sure can. The new medications are even for people who have been treated before and have failed treatment. It's definitely something that someone should go and talk to either their gastroenterologist or infectious disease, whoever is treating the hepatitis C in their city.
It's been said that this disease is becoming more common. Why is that?
Well, that's because we're looking for it. It's actually a rather new disease, and that I can remember even just 15, 20 years ago, we didn't know about hepatitis C. We called it non-A, non-B. So it was just kind of recognized in the early 90s. There wasn't any treatment till the mid-90s, and it wasn't even good treatment. So it's actually a rather new disease. And what we see is most people don't have symptoms. It's a silent virus. The two most common symptoms are fatigue and occasional right upper quadrant pain. That's where your liver is located. So a lot of people don't have any symptoms, so they don't go to their doctor with these problems, and the physician's usually not looking for it. Even if you have liver function tests that are normal, you could still have hepatitis C. That's another big misconception out there, that you don't have to have elevated liver function tests. You can have normal liver function tests and still have hepatitis C. So most people don't know they have hepatitis C. It's actually 4 times more common than HIV. And the CDC just put out an estimation that 3.2 million people are infected. And that could even be more, because we just don't know and we're not really looking for it. I know I heard on the news recently that they are pushing that all baby boomers get tested for hepatitis C. And, you know, another reason is, and I didn't mention earlier, is vaccinations. You know, 20 years ago, vaccinations were given with one gun and everyone had the same needle. And that's certainly a risk factor for hepatitis C, because you're using an unsterilized needle.
Okay, well, you said that there are new medications. What's coming up in the future? You say there are some things in the pipeline for maybe 4 or 5 years from now?
They have some newer ones coming out. What the ones were in May are protease inhibitors. So treatment consists of a shot once a week. It's called an interferon, and it's a pegylated interferon, so it's once a week. And that boosts your immune system to see that virus, for you can kill it yourself. Then there's ribavirin. That's been around for a while, too. We're not sure how that works, but we know it's important. Then the ones that were released in May are telaprevir and Cevic, or bisepivir and Victrelis. Those are the trading generic names. Those actually act like antibiotics. They directly act on that virus and kill that virus. So they have some ones in research that are similar to these protease inhibitors. They still have some polymerase inhibitors, and they're hoping to eventually get away from that shot once a week. But right now, we're not there, and it's probably going to be a good 3-4 years.
Again, the name of Dr. Tuesday Stainbrook's new book is Hepatitis C, What You Need to Know. Nina, Dr. Stainbrook actually surprised me a little bit by saying that hepatitis C can now be cured and saying that there are drugs on the market. And as she was telling us about some of the new ones, are these some of the ones that you know?
Yeah, telaprevir. Yes, definitely. There are 2 new antivirals on the market. But all the drugs that are currently available for hepatitis C, at least for the general public, have to be combined with the interferon that she talked about and the ribavirin. So we're now treating most patients with a 3-drug regimen. The thing is that there is a lot of research going on in terms of hepatitis C, and there are new drugs all the time. And really conceivably, what I'm very excited about is the potential to treat this virus with all oral medications, no injections of interferon. So a cocktail of several different medications, pills, such as how we treat HIV now. So there is a lot going on in terms of hepatitis C, but you can't be treated if you don't know you have it. I think that's the major point.
Well, you brought up HIV. The difference here being is that this will apparently knock the virus right out of you. We're on HIV. We haven't figured out how to do that yet. Or is that true?
Well, that's true. Although in some, what we'd like to do is eradicate hepatitis C. You're quite right. But it may be that even if we can't do that, we can suppress that virus, such as the way we suppress the virus in HIV patients. So even if we can't eradicate it in all patients, if we can bring it down to very, very low levels, then hopefully the patient would not develop chronic liver disease. I mean, that's the hope.
And in the end, it is, you know, trying to save the liver. That is the biggest problem with hepatitis C, is that your liver basically dies.
The liver is inflamed and then gets scarred, and then the end stage would be cirrhosis of the liver. And the other big problem with hepatitis C and cirrhosis is then the development of liver cancer. So these are the things that we're really trying to eradicate and prevent that disease progression.
Still to come, in very rare cases, hepatitis C can be associated with Sjogren's syndrome. What's that? The answer's next on The Health Show. You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a tape or a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1253.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs. Sjogren's syndrome is an autoimmune disorder that affects close to 4 million Americans, the grand majority of them women. From the National Institutes of Health, Leslie Earle reports.
Sjogren's syndrome is a condition that affects between 1 and 4 million Americans. It usually occurs in women after menopause, but it can occur in younger women, in men, and in children.
Sjogren's syndrome is a systemic autoimmune disease.
Dr. Gábor Ile is the head of the Sjogren's Syndrome Clinic at the National Institute of Dental and Craniofacial Research at NIH. He explains that exocrine glands, like the salivary gland that produces saliva, and the lacrimal gland that makes tears, are involved in this autoimmune disease.
In an autoimmune disease, one's own immune system that is there to protect us from viruses, bacteria, cancers, and so on, turn against our own body, and they attack different organs. And this is what is happening in Sjogren's.
Sjogren's can cause dry eyes or dry mouth, but also is associated with rheumatoid arthritis, a painful type of arthritis that causes swelling and stiffness.
There are various forms of Sjogren's syndrome, and For most patients, the most bothersome syndromes are related to the dryness as well as fatigue. But there is a minority of patients who get more severe systemic involvement, like involvement of the lungs, the nervous system. And those people really need more aggressive treatment, whereas the majority of the Sjogren's patients receive mainly symptomatic treatment.
Because tears and saliva are protective, the dryness in Sjogren's can lead to infections and other problems.
We recommend to have plenty of water, and Sjogren's syndrome patients usually have water at their hand all the time, to use certain physical measures to increase saliva production, like the use of sugar-free gums or candies.
Cavities, he notes, are another risk of dry mouth.
In the eyes, we use artificial tears that can be both over-the-counter and when it's more severe than certain glasses, then increase that can protect the eye from drying out. But there are also some medications that we can use in more severe cases.
But how do you know if you have Sjogren's syndrome? Dr. Ile says that diagnosing Sjogren's syndrome is a multi-step process and can take a long time.
One problem with Sjogren's syndrome is that the average time to diagnose Sjogren's is about 7 years from the first symptoms, because the symptoms can be very subtle.
Physicians have to show objective evidence of eye and mouth dryness and that the immune system is attacking the body. Inflammation of the salivary glands and autoantibodies, antibodies that recognize the body's own tissues, are markers of autoimmunity.
So we can measure tear production fairly easily. We can measure saliva production fairly easily. Autoantibodies can be measured in blood tests. And we can do biopsies of the minor salivary glands, which are small glands in the inner side of the lip, and take them out and then look under the microscope if there is inflammation.
Because Sjogren's syndrome can involve so many different parts of the body, including the eyes, mouth, lungs, and joints, patients with the condition often need to see many specialists.
In general, I think that especially if someone has systemic involvement, the rheumatologist should be involved who can manage and coordinate the care. I think it is very useful to have an ophthalmologist, an eye doctor involved, who can really focus on the optimal management of the eye, as well as an oral disease specialist or a dentist who has experience with dry mouth to prevent or correct the effect of dry mouth on the teeth and other structures in the mouth.
As head of the Sjogren's Clinic at NIH, Dr. Ile explains the clinic's role in improving our understanding of how Sjogren's works and in developing new, more effective therapies.
We are very patient-oriented. We do clinical studies. Some of them are just observational, so we follow the disease over time and do certain investigations periodically. And some are interventional, for example, trying out a new treatment or addressing a specific problem of Sjogren's syndrome in more detail. We also include close collaboration with more basic scientists with the goal to find out more about the details of the underlying causes of Sjogren's syndrome.
Dr. Ile adds there are clinical trials on Sjogren's syndrome currently recruiting. To find out more about a clinical trial near you, visit clinicaltrials.gov. To learn more about Sjogren's syndrome and the Sjogren's Clinic, visit nidcr.nih.gov. This is Leslie Earle.
They say money can't buy love, but brownies and chocolate cake, that's another story. Today, our friend Sandy Daigler tells us, when your family equates food with love, what does a salad with low-fat dressing mean?
There is one thing that I've been sure of my entire life, and it is this. Food equals love. My early memories are, for the most part, memories of eating. And with the exception of my father's enthusiastic summer grilling, all of the food I ate as a child was made by the female members of my family. There were my grandmother's potato dumplings, the endless parade of cakes and cookies and casseroles made by an equally endless parade of aunts, my mother's ketchup-drenched meatloaf, substantial and satisfying dishes that filled my belly as they soothed and comforted. What's not to love about that? Well, maybe the fact that after a lifetime of eating that way, I found myself weighing over 250 pounds. You know what happened next, because I've told this story many times, how I got the health wake-up call and lost over 100 pounds, how I've worked diligently for the last 4 years to keep off the weight I lost. I'm a weight loss success story, right? But I'd be lying if I didn't admit that, deep down, I still believe what I've always believed, that food equals love. And that is why this salad-eating health nut still finds herself in the kitchen making brownies for her college-age nephews. It's what a loving aunt does. Lord knows, I've tried to transform that paradigm. Take Thanksgiving. The last few years, I've made an utterly delicious green bean salad for my family's celebration. The recipe calls for lots of herbs and lemon, sweet red peppers and juicy tomatoes, a luscious Dijon mustard vinaigrette. Surely such a concoction could be nothing short of love in your tummy. But what gets all the oohs and ahs? The pumpkin cheesecake made by my sister-in-law. The fact is, healthy food may help you live a longer life and avoid disease, but it is not love, not by a long shot. Yet, I have noticed some changes in my beliefs about food. Recently, I was watching a program on the Cooking Channel. One of my favorite TV chefs was making a dinner for a friend, and as she described the ingredients for a cake she had planned for dessert, I found myself becoming a bit agitated. 2 cups of sugar, 4 egg yolks, a big splash of cream. Is she crazy? I thought. Does she know how much fat and how many calories those things contain? Then it struck me that 5 years ago, my reaction would have been very different. Back then I would have muttered one word, yum. But now it's a brave and strange new world. Last Valentine's Day, I begged my husband not to buy me chocolate. Shocking, you say. After all, isn't chocolate the most special form of love? How could I ask such a thing? Yet I knew that if there were chocolate in the house, I would eat it, and that might lead to eating something else, and then something else. A few extra pounds here or there, maybe more than a few pounds. You know, they don't call them love handles for nothing. So what's a former fat girl to do if food no longer equals love? What replaces the cake with buttercream frosting that my husband wants me to make on his birthday? If I feed him grilled fish and steamed broccoli, low-fat, nutritious fare that nourishes him without elevating his cholesterol level, when what he really craves is prime rib and mashed potatoes with gravy, is that love? So many questions, so few answers. When I was still heavy, I thought losing weight was a simple proposition. Eat less, exercise more. It is that simple, and it's not. Food is love, and it's not. I tell you, the truth just ain't what it used to be. I was looking for love in all the wrong places, looking for love in too many faces.
Sandy Daigler is a writer and architect living in Troy, New York. She denies contemplating an affair with a double stuffed Oreo. That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.